This podcast is brought to you by the North Star, an independent media company fully supported by our members at thenorthstar.com. We are able to speak truth to power without fear or hesitation because people just like you support this work with their monthly and annual contributions. If you're already a member, thank you. If not, join us so that we can continue our liberation journalism through podcasts, articles, activism, and so much more. Again, join us now at thenorthstar.com.
This is Ray King.
And this is Sean King.
And we are
Married to the Movement. Married to the Movement.
These past five, almost 6 years of the movement, and it's hard to believe it's been almost 6 years, I've gone out of my way, and in some ways, you've gone out of your way to stay out of the public eye. But this year, we decided to pivot. And in a minute, I want us to talk about that pivot. But more than that, on this episode of Married to the Movement, I want to give our audience a real introduction to who you are, who you aren't, where you come from, your gifts, your skills, your passions, and all of that. You know, the audience knows me in great part because I have tweeted. I have deleted a lot of tweets, but I have tweeted hundreds of thousands of tweets.
Yeah, that's too much.
And Facebook posts and Instagrams. And, you know, I've recorded, by the time this is out, over 150 episodes of my podcast. And so the audience knows me, and I've lived my life in public for a very long time. But today, honey, if you don't mind, I want to interview you. Interview you for the audience so they can get to know you better. You're on Instagram now.
Yes. I mean, okay, to be fair, I've been on Instagram.
Right.
But privately. For forever.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't like a secret burner account, but it was
it was just my Instagram account. I just chose to never make it public. It was always just
a few dozen family and friends that followed it.
Yeah. And was always constantly going through deleting people. Like, that's how private it was. Like, yeah.
But even now that you're on Instagram, pictures and videos can only say so much about who you are. So in a few minutes, now I'm not going to Dr. Phil and Oprah this.
Okay. What
I'm not going to get too deep in a few minutes. I do want to talk some about your childhood, but I want to start today. Like, can you tell our listeners what you do for a living? What do you do for a living? You have multiple jobs, actually.
Right? Yeah, actually, for like the first time ever. Normally, you're the Jamaican in the house. aren't with all the million and one jobs. But so, yeah, right now, like, I do a couple of things, right? First and foremost, I raise our children in conjunction, in partnership with you. But let's be real. I run things.
Hold on now.
What?
I'm interviewing you. You can't throw the interviewer under the bus.
I wasn't throwing you under the bus. This is just a well-known fact of life in America, the world, really. Okay.
Right, no, but real talk, I'm just being defensive. So much of what happens to raise the kids, I'm there, I'm active, but if something happened to me, they'd get raised damn near just like they're being raised right now. If something happened to you, I don't know what we would do.
Yes, exactly. So, but no, that's my first thing. You know, we have five children, all the way from 20 down to 7 years old. And so, like, we literally have them at every stage, pretty much, of life. And that is the most consuming, most time-consuming thing.
What do you mean by that?
That I do. I mean, gosh, it's just everything, right? From school to homework to birthday parties and dance recitals and, you know, rehearsals and tutoring. And I mean, kids, like, the term momager is normally used to talk about kids like who are somehow in the industry. But every kid has and needs a momager because their lives have to
What's a momager? What is that?
You know, like someone who.
A mom and manager?
Yeah, like Kris Jenner, for instance. You know, like,
right.
You know, she is the momager. But every kid needs a manager. And so, and we have that times five. And the 20-year-old really doesn't need a whole lot less managing than she did.
We're learning that the hard way.
Oh, yeah, right? Man. I thought when she was out to college, it was like, all right, one down, four to go. It's like, oh, no, no, no. Oh, what? You're calling me at 3 a.m. because you're sick? Like, hey, you're 500 miles away. What am I going to do?
Right.
So, no. But that's the main thing still that I do. But I do also work outside of the home. Now, I've been an educator my entire life. And for the rest of my life, I think I will think of myself as a teacher first. I did that for 16 years, was an elementary school teacher. Absolutely loved it. I never actually wanted to do anything other than teach. I was never one of those teachers that was like, you know, oh, I'm going back to school so I can become a principal and be an instructional coach and then I'm going to do this. It's like, no, I literally just want to teach.
Even as people, I think, wanted to put you on the track to become a principal, you're like, nah, I want to be a teacher.
Yeah, I want to be a teacher. I absolutely loved it.
I'm gonna ask you some questions about that in a second because this past year is the first year in a very long time that you weren't a full-time teacher.
And
so you entered
This year and last year, actually.
Right.
I wasn't a teacher last year either. So right now, actually, what I'm doing is I am a director of equity and learning for a national nonprofit. And so just really helping to shape policy and learning around shifting organizational culture to be more equitable.
What does that mean?
In its practices. And, well, I mean, really, it's in a lot of ways a teaching position. You know, I do a lot of teaching on race in particular and what it means to be socialized around race and how that shows up in organizations and the way that we treat our people.
You mean like bias?
Bias, yeah, but not just bias, just literally race, you know, and what it means to be a Black person in a white dominant organization, what it means to be a white person working with people of color in a white dominant organization.
Issues of privilege
and issues of policies that are shaped and designed to benefit one group of workers over another, that creates psychological safety for one set of workers and not another. And how do we shift that so that we have a more equitable organization? And so that's the work that I do now. It is difficult. I think it is the hardest thing that I've ever done, actually.
Give us an example, an illustration of what's difficult about it. I mean, I can imagine, but...
Well, I mean, because you're talking about people's identity, right? You're talking about how people see themselves. We all want to view ourselves as being good people, right? Like, I'm a good person. And sometimes when you stay stuck in that, and it is very difficult to examine the ways in which that might not be so true or the ways in which you are holding biases and upholding systems of oppression as a good person, you know, and asking you to examine that about yourself so that we can tear those systems down and make space and room for others. That's not so easy.
One of the things I've learned because, you know, you come home and share with me about your day is this equity work is not just hard for white folk to experience.
No, it's hard for people of color. Because I think in a lot of ways as people of color, you know, we grow up socialized around race in a way that teaches us how we need to show up in order to be successful. And some of us have mastered that, right? And so to have someone come into your place of work and kind of decolonize, help you to decolonize yourself. Some people don't want to be decolonized.
Right. They fight. Even good folk resist.
Yeah.
Because
I'm the Black person on this team, and and these are my white friends, I'm not Black. I am this other thing that is Black adjacent, you know, and I don't want to name it. I don't want to claim it. I'm uncomfortable with it. I don't want to talk about it. Or also, actually, I am very Black, and I'm very proud of it, and I'm tired, and I don't want to have this conversation at work because I have to have this conversation in so many other spaces. Work is the one place where where I don't want to have this conversation.
I hope to
it's
show
painful.
Up here and not have to deal with
Absolutely.
This.
So it's like a wide range of reasons why this kind of work could be difficult and hard for people. And so I have to navigate that with as my Black self, right?
Right.
Coming with all my own issues as well. Have to stand in this place where I'm asking people to do really difficult work.
As a woman as well.
As a Black woman,
right.
Absolutely. So often Black women, we take on, these tasks and these burdens, and actually going to be having these conversations as a podcast that we'll be releasing through the North Star with another good friend of mine who also does this work. It's kind of like a secret industry that a lot of people aren't aware of.
What is a secret industry?
This industry of women of color who are going into corporations and organizations and doing this equity work. See, a lot of people, they know activists, they know, influencers that they follow on Twitter and, these social media spaces who do this work. But there's this other industry, a lot more hidden, where you have, like one of my Spelman sisters just became the head of diversity at Starbucks.
Right.
ACLU, I think, just hired a Black woman to be their head of diversity. I think it was the ACLU. I have a girlfriend who goes, who has her own company that does this work, and she does work with places like MasterCard and Disney. And
in some ways, hearing you talk about it, I would almost frame it as like institutional activism.
Institutional activism, 100%. Except a lot of these companies will shy away from that term activism.
Oh,
and
sure.
they'll specifically say, well, we're not looking for activists here.
Well,
which I think is very interesting.
I know why they say that, but I'm saying it is what it is that, these companies in some ways have found themselves in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And often are told you need to hire somebody to help you through this equity work that your corporation needs to be doing.
Yeah. And so what we find is like social media tends to be like at the forefront of any movement. It starts it. It puts it out there. And then you have all these other sectors that are a couple years behind and, kind of catching up to it. And so, you had the Black Lives Matter movement at the forefront of things about 5 or 6 years ago. And the organization that I work for, they wouldn't even touch it. You know what I'm saying? It was just like it was the third rail. If someone was shot, and there was an instance of police brutality, this organization and many organizations, they weren't sending out a mass email, acknowledging that it happened, comforting their workers. Like, that never would have happened.
Wow.
5 or 6 years ago. But then 5 or 6 years ago, you had something like the shooting that happened in the Orlando club, that was a anti-LGBTQ plus issue, and companies were a lot more comfortable, addressing that and sending out messages. And then you had Black people in these organizations saying, but okay, great, glad you did that. But what about this thing right here that you are so uncomfortable acknowledging? And so here we are many years later, and companies are really now getting to the point where they're acknowledging that, these conversations need to be had. And they're bringing in people to do it. And these people, by and large, are Black women and other women of color into these spaces.
Hearing you say that and hearing you tell stories every day about your work, I kind of see you as like the chief of difficult conversations.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That is such a great title and is actually like spot on.
Right.
Because, yeah, it is. It's the chief of difficult conversations. It is the chief teacher of things about race, chief eye opener, chief awareness raiser.
And consequently, a lot, because you are in this role in this corporation as equity director, then people now also come to you with their problems regarding issues of equity, racism, bias.
Yeah, and it's, if their manager, if they feel like their manager is treating them a particular way, because of their race, I'm definitely going to hear about it. And in a lot of ways, you know, am expected to have an answer or remedy for it. And so it's difficult because this work is actually so new still.
Right.
There's not really like a blueprint for how do you take a white dominant organization from its current practices, which in a lot of ways uphold systems of oppression. How do you move an organization from that to an equity organization? There's not really a blueprint. There are people who've been doing this work for a while that whose scholarship and work that you can lean on, but not a whole lot. And
you,
so it's a lot
of— You are still pioneers.
100%.
Very
yeah,
much so.
So that's what I do. But then also, as you well know, I help run the North Star.
Right.
This company that you started about a year ago.
That's right.
As its operations officer and manager. And so, yeah, my hands are full.
So here at Married to the Movement, we're all about looking out for new ideas to try to make our lives easier, especially with having the kids and the rest of the family stuck in the house together.
Social distancing has been especially hard for us because we miss working out. If you follow me on Instagram at Mrs. Ray King, then you've seen me post workout videos of me dancing. So recently, we found a streaming app called Bulldog Online, which offers easy-to-stream yoga workouts with great music playlists. Bulldog was recently featured in USA Today, Newsweek, Allure Magazine, Health.com, and more. We really like Bulldog Online because they have such a great variety of classes, like these really cool, more cardio-infused classes, along with more traditional, slower flow classes, but with very easy-to-follow instructions. Plus, their app makes streaming super convenient, even if you want to do it outside.
What's even better is that they offer a 30-day free trial just to test it out. And on top of that, if you use our custom promo code, which is KING50, that's no spaces, KING50, if you use that code when you create your profile, you'll get 50% off of your second month. So it's only $6 after the 30-day free trial.
Just check them out at bulldogonline.com. And that promo code again is KING50, no spaces. Good luck and let us know what you think.
Married to the Movement.
What do you do in that role? Let me even introduce my great limitations here.
Mm-hmm.
The longer I live and lead, the more I've come to understand. I illustrated to people like this that there are 100 skills that any given person could have. I've grown to accept that I have like somewhere between 2 to 4 of those 100 skills.
I don't know, love. I'd give you a few more.
Well, no, it is to say
5 to 10.
I do a small number of things really well, and then there are a lot of things that I don't do well at all, and I just don't.
I just want to pause right there because, like, that is such a moment of growth. Like, there. I don't know if a year ago you could have made that statement so clear-minded and so definitively. Like, yeah.
No, I think it did take me. And I have a book that comes out this spring, and I have a whole chapter where I talk about learning that lesson, learning about my limitations as a leader, and I've just learned. And I always want to be getting better, but I've learned that I am just not, no matter how bad I want to be, I'm just not a good manager of people. And you are. And you seem, if I'm right, seem to like managing people. You joke and say you like telling people what to do.
No, I really, it's not that I like telling people what to do. I don't. I would much rather work with people and have people work with me who already know what to do and actually who tell me what needs to be done in a particular field or area. So it's not that I like telling people what to do. I have a whole lot of that at home. And so would love it if that weren't the case in my workplace. What I do enjoy is grappling with how organizations you know, get the best out of people and you know, inspire people to do their best work and to show up as their full selves. I love grappling with how we do that, how we make people feel valued and heard and seen and like they're operating in their optimal space, like in their gifts. And so in that way, I like, quote unquote, managing people, but I like managing organizations and the people that are in them. I like helping them.
We're in the podcast studio of the North Star right now. What are some of the things you do day to day at the North Star?
Oh, gosh. So, you know, really bringing just going back to this word again, organization to it. I mean, you are a visionary. You are a big picture, big ideas guy. And it's something that I've grown to appreciate about you. It can be annoying because you always have an idea. I think in your head right now, you've literally got five different projects that you could start tomorrow if I let you.
That's actually literally the truth.
Yeah. You've talked to me about them and all of them. I'd be like, nope, not doing that, not happening. And you know what? It's a gift, really, because I'm not like that. I'll have an idea, and my idea is probably going to stay an idea, not you. You think, you know, you've accepted that every idea you have is good enough to run with it. And I'm like, wow, it's a beautiful thing to have that level of confidence. And that's been really difficult over the years because you've started a lot of things and not run them well.
Right.
And that has been really, really hard. And so with the North Star, I have stepped in, several months ago to really help take this vision for this company that you have that really focuses on media that points people towards freedom. I believe it's a worthy goal and cause. And so what I do day to day is just help manage the details of that, like who's doing what projects are coming. Have we mapped it out? Who's managing whom? What is the framework that we're using for our management system? Do we have all the things in place behind the scenes? Are people set up to be paid properly? Is their insurance working? Are the bills getting paid?
And one of the things you do well is you're helping us have systems of evaluation where people are evaluated for how well they're doing their job.
Right, and how well they enjoy their job and feel supported in their work as well. So, yeah, that's what I do here.
So you do that here at the North Star. You're an equity director, but for most of our adult lives, you've been a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to me about your life and journey as an educator.
Yeah, so, you know, I graduated from Spelman as an education major, went right into teaching. I tell people I've taught in basically every way there is to teach. I started out in parochial school.
What's that mean?
Religious school, you know.
Oh,
I
that's
taught
right.
at the
mm-hmm.
Methodist school. And I always tell people that I think that's the best way. Teaching in a small private school was such a gift for me as a young teacher because it gave me so much freedom to learn my craft and to grow in it without the pressure of, you know, a rigid
standardized test.
Yeah, 100%. We didn't do any of that stuff. And so it was a real gift to me to be able to start teaching in that way.
That seems like a lifetime ago.
I mean, it really was. It was Kindy's lifetime ago, really.
Our 17-year-old was a baby, basically.
Yeah, when I did that. And so then left there and taught in public school for several years. I homeschooled for 6 years after that, where I
was. Slow down. Hold on. You taught in public school where?
I mean,
I want to know.
Already know.
Why? But the listeners don't know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's what I'm not. I know you're talking to me, but.
Yeah, I mean, in Atlanta, I taught in public school. I taught first grade for several years. And, you know, until I gave birth to Savannah, our now 10-year-old. And when we had her, I decided I wanted to stay home. At that point, I think we had four kids. Is that
right? That's right, yeah.
Tay, Kendi.
Mm-hmm.
Easy and Savannah. Yeah, we had four kids at that point, and it was becoming a lot to maintain. And I decided to stay at home. At that point, and my goal was to stay at home until Savannah was school age, which is basically
right,
what I did.
Right.
But I also ended up homeschooling them. My best friend at the time was homeschooling and had this whole community, and they were always getting together and just having a really good time. And that was actually one of my favorite periods of our lives together, was when I was able to homeschool the kids. We had a really good time.
So when you talk about teaching in every kind of way, you taught at religious schools, public schools, the homeschooling the kids.
Charter school. When I did come back into teaching after homeschooling, I went into a charter school.
Where?
Charter schools weren't such a big thing, you know, when I left teaching to be at home. But by the time I came back 5-6 years later, I mean, they were everywhere.
The whole game had
changed. Oh, completely. I mean, completely. We went from George Bush's No Child Left Behind, which is
right,
really what was being done in schools. When I left, and then I came back, and
charter schools were everywhere.
Oh gosh, they were everywhere. And so did that, and then we even traveled to South Africa, where I was able. I've everywhere we've gone, I've found children to teach.
What
it was
is
just
it about
in me.
What is it about that you love
about teaching?
Yeah,
I mean, oh my gosh, you know, I always just felt like it was my gift. Like, you know, there's this concept of flow.
Right.
And I've never experienced it like I do when I'm in the classroom.
Can you explain just a little bit what that concept means? It's kind of esoteric, but what do you mean by flow?
Like, just when you are so sure that you are in, like, to make a religious comparison, it's like being in the center of God's will, you know, for your life. And
in the zone.
In the zone, you know, and I have never experienced that like I do when I'm in the classroom with students. I know what to do. I know what to say. I'm never flustered or overwhelmed. It just comes to me. Like, you know what I'm saying? And I know how to deal with students who are difficult. I know how to reach them. I know how to connect with them who are difficult for other teachers. I just always felt like it was my gift. And I loved it. And particularly that first to second grade, even third grade age group. I just felt like it was the thing that I was supposed to be doing. And so I did it for a long time and loved it. But we went to South Africa, and I connected with an organization there that
right,
was really building, you know, schools out of nothing.
Right.
Because education there, at least at the time, was not compulsory. I don't know if it is now, but I think that
there were entire communities of children that weren't attending any kind of school.
Right, yeah, they couldn't afford it.
Right.
They couldn't afford to go. And so I hooked up with an organization that was setting up schools in different townships and trying, you know, just with volunteers, really, to provide an education. And I really helped them to create a curriculum for those kids.
Right.
I helped to train the teachers that they were working with and show them how to teach students. And gosh, looking back on that experience, is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those kids didn't even speak English. We didn't even speak the same language. Looking back on it, it doesn't seem like it at all. Like, I don't remember language being a barrier. We just found ways to communicate with one another. I fell in love with those kids. I
right,
think about them all the time still.
We had them over to our house.
Yeah, and I wonder how they're doing. But
yeah.
So, I mean, any way that teaching can happen.
Even when we got back from South Africa and moved to California, and you started teaching in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Do I have the timeline right there?
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, I started teaching in L.A. at a charter school, and that was a learning experience. I had all my teaching experience to that point had really been in the South.
And had also almost always been with Black children.
Yeah, absolutely, in Atlanta. And so here I was now in L.A., teaching, you know, predominantly Latinx kids. And that was a learning curve for me. I wrongly assumed, and I tell this story all the time when I'm doing equity workshops, because for me, it was an instance where I had to become self-aware and I had to realize what my biases were, and I had to learn a community in order to be effective in that community. I went in there assuming that the things that I had done, the sensibilities that carried me through my time in Atlanta in classrooms, those same sensibilities were going to work for me in East LA, and that just was not true.
Right.
I did not go in with an immediate level of trust with those parents. As a matter of fact, it was the opposite. It was distrust, because that neighborhood was rapidly changing from a predominantly Black neighborhood to a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. There was a lot of tension.
A lot of tension and skepticism.
Yeah.
And it wasn't new. It was like had been going on for a long time.
Right. And so I didn't know that. I didn't do my research before I went into that community.
And I remember learning with you, we grew up in Kentucky and we, you know, moved to Atlanta and spent a lot of our time there, that the Hispanic community in Los Angeles is something altogether different than what we experience in Atlanta, in Kentucky.
Yeah, like I was an idiot. To me, Hispanic meant Mexican. You know what I'm saying? And I learned from that experience. My kids came from everywhere, all kinds of countries in South America and also from Mexico. And that meant different things.
Right.
You know, like they're not all the same. But I was dumb. You know what I'm saying? And I didn't.
We both were, right?
Yeah, I didn't think through any of that. And I learned very quickly through some hard lessons that I was going to have to show up differently than I ever had. And I had to show up in ways that recognized my students and my parents for who they were and what their expectations were and their ways of being. And so that's a lesson that I carry with me through my equity work now in helping others to understand what's necessary if we're going to work responsibly across difference.
Right.
Yeah. And so after teaching in L.A., we moved to Atlanta, where
back
I taught again.
Back to Atlanta,
where I taught again.
At a great school that you
liked. Oh, my gosh, that I loved. And then up here to New York. And let me tell you something. Teaching in New York is no joke, okay?
Right.
Like, it was difficult. I like to say that kids are kids, and that's really true. Like, everywhere that I've been, everywhere that I've taught, you know, as far as, like, the spirit and energy that they carry, kids are kids. But culture is a thing, and every place has its culture, and the culture in New York was just very different for me, you know.
I tell people this, that New York is as close to being, New York City is as close to being another country as anything the United States has.
Yeah.
It is so unique culturally that if you come here not quite knowing what to expect, it's a big shift.
Yeah, and so the kids here, you know, they're sweet or whatever, but they weren't as like, you know, immediately attached to me. You know, there's a little more skeptical. And, you know, I had to work a little bit harder here to kind of earn their trust and their respect.
With the parents, too.
Oh, yeah, with the parents, too. But, you know, I've taught in classrooms here, and I've absolutely fallen in love with kids. As you know, it's not hard for me to do. And learned a lot. Charter schools are a major thing here, and that was a learning curve. Even though I taught in a charter school in L.A., it was nothing like the charter system here, where you have these enormous, you know.
New York may be ground zero for the charter school movement.
Yeah, for sure, especially when you have the success academies and, you know, Achievement First and, you know, uncommon schools, all these
mega
schools.
Systems.
Yeah,
of charter schools.
Absolutely. And so did that for a couple of years and then decided that it was time for me to do something different.
Mm.
That, you know, I had been teaching for so long and I could pretty much predict with a certain level of accuracy, you know, how my school year was going to go from year to year.
Yeah.
I was going to have some students that were a little bit challenging, but we were going to work through it.
Right.
You know.
Some parents, they're going to be a little bit challenging.
Oh,
through that.
Yeah, going to work through that, too. But my kids were going to grow. They were going to have a good time. And it became a little predictable. And I got to the point where I wanted to challenge myself.
Right.
I did eventually think about becoming a school principal, but knew that I had never had to work with adults, you know, so much. when you're in a school, your classroom is your domain,
right,
and you run that thing. You are the gatekeeper. It is whatever you make it. And you don't really have to interact a whole lot with people outside of that classroom. And so I'd never had to lead adults before. And I thought if I am interested in being a school principal one day, I should go somewhere and see how I feel about working with and leading adults, which led me to the organization that I work with now as an instructional coach is how I went there first, and then transitioned to being their equity and learning director.
Hey, my name is Brandon Janice, and I'm the host of Sick Empire, a brand new podcast brought to you by the North Star. On Sick Empire, I interview New Yorkers who, in different ways, fight on the front lines for change in the city during the coronavirus pandemic. Please listen to hear a unique mix of stories from essential workers, small business owners, artists, and elected officials who are all experiencing the chaos of COVID in their own ways. Listen to Sick Empire on all streaming platforms, and you can support the show and any of our other podcasts by heading over to thenorthstar.com and becoming a member.
Sick Empire. Sick Empire.
So that brings us to today. And I said at the beginning of this interview, I do want to go back a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about your childhood. You you know, you and I both grew up in Kentucky, but you also spent some time in Cincinnati, which you like to claim Cincinnati more than you like to claim Kentucky.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, obviously I was born in Kentucky, but then moved when I think I was like 4 or 5 years old, and started school in Cincinnati and did all of elementary school.
Hold on. I have to slow you down just a little bit.
What?
Just for our listeners, because obviously I know your whole story, but... you had a single mother.
Yeah.
And that you love and that loved you. You had a sister and a brother and, and you know, in the house. Slow down a little bit.
Well, you know, like, I'm not as comfortable with this whole telling my whole life story.
Well, no, I mean,
like you said,
to...
you've had, like, hundreds of thousands of posts and stuff. There is a reason that my life has been private.
I know. You don't have to tell every detail, but I just want people to understand what that looked like. So... your mother, your mother, Tony, my mother-in-law, who I love, you all moved from Kentucky, from Lexington, where you were born, and you all moved up to Cincinnati.
Yeah.
You and your mother and your sister. And what?
I have an older brother, too, but he's like 11 years older than me, so we didn't really grow up together in the same house.
I don't
house.
Know if Derek will ever listen to this podcast.
So
it's doubtful. So we might be able to crack some Derek jokes, some jokes about
about his essential oils.
Yeah, yeah, some bootleg essential oils that he wants to sell or give.
Oh,
or, you know.
Hush, no.
All right.
Yeah. So yeah, we moved to Cincinnati,
and you loved it there.
I did. I loved Cincinnati. I mean. For me, in a lot of ways, it was probably like a precursor to what it's like living in New York. But being in Cincinnati allowed me a whole lot of opportunities and a lot of freedom of movement that I don't think I would have gotten had we stayed in Lexington. I went to a performing arts school. Well, first of all, I started out being able to go to a bilingual school where I learned everything I learned in English, I learned in Spanish as well. So the little bit of Spanish I know and very little bit of Spanish, I learned all the way back in kindergarten, first, second, third grade. You know what I'm saying? It's the best time for a child to learn a language is as young children. But yeah, I did that. And then I went to the School for Creative and Performing Arts, SCPA.
Which is still there and,
I mean,
it's still a big deal.
Historic school.
Right.
Where actually a lot of Fame was filmed, if I remember that correctly. or was it 21 Jump Street? It was something that was really famous. That was filmed there. But yeah, a really historic school there in Cincinnati. And I had the best childhood. Like, we were poor, you know, again, had a single mother. And, you know, we did not have a lot at all. Like, I have so many struggle stories. I could tell, but at the same time, I just had a really good childhood. We were raised in church. Church was our life. We were there several days of a week, you know, choir rehearsal, Bible study, you know, pastor's anniversary committee, like whatever it was that needed to be
done. Your mother did all the things.
Oh, she did all the things. And I loved it. Yeah. You know, like, it was such a great community to be a part of as a child. I had so many quote unquote aunts, yeah. You know what I'm saying? That were my mom's friends, that mm-hmm. were church ladies. There were always eyes on us, always people telling us what to do, making sure we stayed on the straight and narrow. There was the children's choir, and church gave me an opportunity very early on to be a leader. I remember being maybe 7 or 8 years old, and I got to direct the adult choir because I was fascinated by the choir directors and the fact that, you know, they had all these hand movements that could, you know, quiet one section and raise another one and make something staccato and cut it off. And, you know, like, I loved it.
I don't know that you ever told me that. I think that's first time I've heard that.
Oh, yeah.
I can see that, too. I can see it. I can definitely see
it. Yeah, I remember them introducing me and somebody saying, and you know, we have Ray Tanisha Adams, which is my name at the time, you know, making her directorial debut. And I was.
What
I was,
church was this?
This was a Progressive Baptist church. Oh, my gosh.
Uh-huh. What was the pastor's name?
His name was Reverend Threets. actually, he was such a great pastor. A small church. It was everything to me, that community. And from giving Easter speeches to directing the choir to singing solos in the Rosebud Children's Choir is what it was called. I first learned that I was a leader, right? Like, I was somebody that people could listen to and could follow, and I had ideas, and that all of that was encouraged and nurtured.
We don't think about it, but, you know, you're born in 1981, which is just 12 years after Dr. King was assassinated.
Wow, that's wild.
And these churches in the 80s, and that's what we're talking about, you at these churches in the 80s, mm-hmm. were very much just like they were in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Like, they were still communities, and churches and communities were still stable.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, you lived around the people you went to church with,
mm-hmm.
and the community was very connected in a way that,
I mean, these are the people I spent all my time with, you know. So even when we weren't in church, we were with the people that we went to church mm-hmm. with. And so every holiday, gatherings for birthdays were at my Auntie Vaughn's house.
Mm-hmm.
Big, huge gatherings, lots of food, lots of kids. Watching Michael Jackson videos and Disney movies, and it just created like a really safe cocoon for me to grow up in. And I'm forever grateful to my mom for raising us in that way, and you know, offering us that protection, but also that instruction that even though I struggle with church now and my place in it, like, I know how to go to God, and I know how to pray, and I know how to search the scriptures and be encouraged by it. And it's all because she saw fit to raise me in that way, in that community.
You still lean on your faith in that
absolutely,
way.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, there's so many more questions I have. You know, like, when you went to SCPA, you know, which was this really kind of elite performing arts school,
mm-hmm.
were you thinking at that time that you would always be a performer?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. Like, and my mom, she was so encouraging of it. Like, one of my earliest memories is when we first moved to Cincinnati. And for some reason, she took me to audition for this play. It was called River Crossings. And I mean, I would like to talk to her, actually. I need to ask her more about how that came to be. Like, did she see an advertisement in the paper? Like, mm-hmm. like, what made her take me to go and do this thing? I remember the audition and everything. It's one of my earliest memories. And I loved the stage. I loved performing. I loved to sing. I loved to act. I just loved everything about being surrounded by these creative people. And it's so interesting now to see that in our children and all the things that they do. And our daughter, our 17-year-old, who goes to a performing arts school and is an aspiring filmmaker. But yeah, you know, the creative community, they're so accepting, you know, and loving. And when I think about roaming the halls of SCPA as I did, you know, before school, after school, in between performances, I mean, just the best memories.
We even Googled your name and like saw you listed on.
Yeah, like an album.
Album. What was that?
That album, it was like, it was a performance that our school choir, one of our school choirs did with the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra.
Oh, right.
And so, yeah, you can Google that and still see it. I wish I could get a copy of that. I wish I could also get a copy of River Crossings. I've tried to Google it and kind of see a few blurbs about
it.
Yeah,
we saw that it existed there in Cincinnati.
Yeah, but it's hard to find those things.
It was powerful because earlier this year, I spoke at the National Abolitionist Museum in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Which is right on the Ohio River.
Yeah.
Which was what that play was about.
Yeah, it was all about this. It took, it followed, like, I think it was like a particular family through several decades, several generations. And it was called River Crossings, and it told that story of a family crossing. And I can remember as a child, like, the scene where we're, like, wading through the water and trying to get to the other side.
It's actually... The Ohio River, and the story is, and this is true, that if you were in Kentucky and crossed over the Ohio River, technically, you had escaped to freedom. Now, there would be people there waiting to catch you, take you back, and there was a whole industry, and I learned about that at the museum. But when I stared at the river, it was a surreal moment. Like, it's not a creek.
Yeah.
It's a huge river.
So this idea that people were literally risking their lives, you know, to wade across it towards freedom, that's what that play was about.
And
I didn't understand any of that, mind you.
Oh, right.
As a 5 and 6-year-old, I had no idea.
You just played your part.
But yeah.
What's funny to me is then, you know, 8 or 9 years after you were in that play, when I first saw you, you were also still, and you were in a church play.
Yeah, that's true.
And
by that point, I was not thinking of myself as any kind of performer or anything like that. When we left Cincinnati to move back to Lexington, my last year of middle school, it was torture. I mean, I knew my life was over. I hated it.
You went from having a community that you were a part of, that you loved, and you were a part of this elite performing arts school, to just going to your local neighborhood middle school, and it's like...
It was torture.
Yeah.
And I was so different, right? Because performing arts kids are very different. And here I am showing up full of confidence, full of myself, to this place where, first of all, it's middle school, okay?
And which sucks in general.
I mean, it just sucks in general, right?
I damn near think we should just, like...
do away with it?
Yeah, do away with middle
school. No, there are people who talk about that, honestly, and say that kids learn nothing because their brains are too busy being crazy and concentrating on everything else, that it's just, school is almost a waste of time.
It's been virtually miserable for every one of our children.
Yeah, it has.
They all
babies.
Have loathed middle school in their own. They each loathed it differently.
Yeah.
But none of them have had a phenomenal middle school experience.
No, and our thing to them is always like, just get through it. Like, none of this will matter.
Right.
And now, you know, our 20-year-old and 17-year-old can look back on it and be like, oh, my gosh, like, I can't believe how much it does not matter, you know? But, yeah, I hated it. I hated it when we moved to Lexington. I was so incredibly miserable. I couldn't make connections with people in the same way. I just lived a very different life than they had lived. And, it was torture.
And so you and I found a kinship in a way that we were both desperate to escape Kentucky?
Oh, 100. Listen, from the moment I stepped foot, I was counting down the days until I could leave. It was a really difficult time for my family.
Yeah, it was.
You know, my mother was struggling with financially, which is why we even moved back to Lexington so that she could have, you know, the support of her family. But my extended family was struggling. My sister, my younger sister, was having a very difficult time. It was just, you know, I look back on that time and those years in Lexington where, you know, that last year, middle school and high school, and it was dark. You know what I'm saying? It was. And again, church was a respite for me. Which is where you and I met. You know, you were also having your own difficult journey.
Yeah, I was coming out of my own struggles and
challenges.
Yeah,
so we were having these parallel experiences. And so when we found each other, oh, my gosh, it was just like...
Oh, that reminds me that I don't know if we've ever shared this here on the podcast before, but that when you were in middle school, and maybe I was in middle school as well.
Oh, Lord.
That we both were at the same talent show.
Yeah.
Rap is Art is Life.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the whole talent show was hip hop.
I guess.
Yeah, now that I think back,
you know, I have
it.
A terrible memory, a horrible memory. I don't know if I'm trying to protect myself or what, but I've blocked out like a big chunk of my life, and that's part of it.
So you and I did not meet each other until several years later, and then into our relationship, we eventually learned that we were actually in the same space. And as I think about it, like, you know those movies where, like, you go back in time and you're not supposed to bump into yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I wonder if we had bumped into each other.
Right.
And kind of like, nah, not really felt each other. Then had we seen each other later, it would be like, oh, that's just that so-and-so.
Right, right.
Yeah, we might have blown the whole thing seen each other.
That's so crazy. That's so creepy. But yeah, we were at the same talent show. Didn't know it until many years later because I was a rapper. And it's really the most ridiculous part of my life to think back on, like, a rapper, seriously. I mean, I could bust a rhyme now. I am a really good freestyler.
We'll figure out a way to integrate that into one of the episodes.
Yes,
somewhere.
Okay. I mean, because you say I rap like Kumo D, but Kumo D was fly. So whatever on that.
Let me say this about Kumo D. I did grow up loving Kumo D, but if you go back and play certain hip hop, you realize like certain hip hop you go back and play from the '80s, and you're like, oh, that stands the test of time.
Oh, Kumo D don't stand the test of time.
About half of Kumo D kind of barely makes the cut.
Whatever. Listen, I will tell you, though, I was so fly as a rapper back in the day, okay? I don't remember what my rap name was. I really wish I did. I don't. But I do remember a couple of lines. Like, I had one that was like... Let me say it.
Go ahead. What was the line?
Okay, now I can't. Okay, now I'm too.
Okay,
I'm too embarrassed.
All right. Okay. We're gonna do
one
it on
of
one of these
days. Yeah, it'll be a treat.
Wow, you almost.
But I was kind of known, like a little bit, at least in my school circles, as, you know, a rapper.
Well, you were cute and spunky and had a big personality and was busting some rhymes. You know,
whatever. That's a weird chapter in my life.
Well, you know, part of what I wanted to do today was just take our audience through a small journey just of your life and to tell some of your story that doesn't always make it onto IG.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, as we trend on Twitter or whatever, like this type of part of who you are is bigger than that. Are there any things about yourself? Are there parts of your story that we haven't covered that you might like to add? Anything you're like, oh, I wish we had talked about so-and-so?
I mean, no, I don't wish we had talked about any of it. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I always find it intriguing that people have any interest whatsoever in our lives. You know what I'm saying? Like, you talked about trending on Twitter. It blows my mind. I'm just like, people are that into you and what you say or what you don't say or do that enough people are going to talk about it to make it a trending topic. Like, I think Twitter is dead, honestly. Like, at the point at which you can trend just randomly like that, I think it's, you know, it's a stupid place. That's not serious, in my opinion. But I went to Spelman. Loved my time at Spelman. Made some of the best friends of my life there. You know, I lament it now because the student loans are unbearable. Like I was trying to explain to our 17-year-old about college and loans and why that's not what, you know, you and I are trying to have her do. And I was like, listen, I paid $14,000 in student loan payments this year, and it was all interest. Okay,
like, the principal didn't
do
didn't
you
go
know
down.
How depressing that is?
It's a scam.
It is a scam, and it makes me so angry. And it's one of the reasons why we support Bernie Sanders, because nobody, like, how am I ever going to be done with that?
Right.
I can't, you know,
because here
I'm
we
saying?
Are now, our kids are in college.
Yes.
And we're having to support them,
right?
And we still have our own damn student loans,
right? You know, so it's like we're never going to be out.
It's a vicious cycle
from under it. And so yeah, I regret that, but I don't regret going to Spelman. Spelman was what I needed. You
it
know,
was a beautiful experience.
I could not wait to get out of Kentucky. You know, there were some good times. I did marching band. I was part of the color guard.
Oh, back in Kentucky, yeah, in high school.
Back in Kentucky, yeah. And so, you know, played the French horn for 7 or 8 years. Loved that. But I could not wait to leave Kentucky, and Spelman was my refuge. Like, it was a whole new world of Black excellence. I stepped on the campus, and I was like, these are the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. And they looked every kind of way, came from every kind of place. I was like, how did Sean stay faithful to me for 2 years?
Oh, no. No, I dug you, though.
I couldn't have stayed faithful to me.
No, but, I mean, you know, I was crazy about you, and you know, I'm fiercely loyal.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. When I got to Spelman, I was like, wait, what is going on here? And they were smart, and they were confident, and they were leaders. And that's the beautiful thing, I think, about, gendered education, if you will. It's kind of, you know, going out of not fashion or style, but it's becoming harder and harder these days as we grapple with gender and what it means to be gendered and who can be a woman,
sure,
and who can be male and all those kinds of things. But one of the benefits of, you know, having single sex education is that for women, it allowed us to be leaders at every sector and at every point of the college. And so if there was going to be a student government president, she was going to be a woman. You know what I'm saying? If there was going to be a head of the robotics team, she was going to be a woman. You know what
a
I'm saying?
Woman.
A Black woman,
right,
at that. And it was just a really empowering environment where I got to grapple with all these ideas and struggle with my faith in light of what this scholar said and this person said. And I loved it. I loved my time at Spelman. And so, you know, that's the only thing I guess I haven't talked about that is a big part of my life and what shaped me.
Morehouse and Spelman shaped us both in major ways. And I mean, the audience will get to know you and us more and more. But I just thought it was important for you to be able to share some of your story. You know, I love you and I'm crazy about you.
Well, I know, of course. And, you know, great. Thanks. I'm glad. You know, this whole thing about, I guess, quote unquote, being public and having so many people asked me, and I never, you know, really addressed it, why I chose to go public.
Sure.
You know, at this point in time. And I think for me, you know, I am such a private person. I'm the kind of person that doesn't need or want like a whole lot of people around me. I'm good when I have two or three really good close friends.
Right.
I can go either way in terms of introvert versus extrovert. I think, you know, this last year has caused me to be a little more introverted.
Sure.
But I mean, I love a good party. I love to hang out with people. But in terms of like who's close to me, I don't allow or need a whole lot of that. And so was very content to have a private life and, a private social media. And really, though, got to the point this year where, first of all, just the foolishness and all the lies and the craziness that people were saying about you and then, about me by proxy, got to be too much. And I felt like I had allowed myself to be silenced in a way that was a detriment to me and to us and to our family. And I no longer wanted that. Like, I'm a strong-willed person. I have a voice that I generally don't shy away from using. And I felt like, I had allowed myself to be silenced in a way that I was just no longer comfortable with. And that doesn't mean that I've invited people into every aspect of my life. What I like about my social media is when I have something to say, I say it.
Right.
When I don't, I don't. I don't feel this need to, oh my gosh, I have to post every day. I have to post several times a day. I'm not trying to be a personality or, I'm not trying to, make this my, I'm not trying to monetize it and be hashtag sponsored, as my kids would say. Oh, mom, you should have a public social media. You would be hashtag sponsored. Like, I'm not trying to be hashtag sponsored. You know what I'm saying? I don't need that.
Is that what people really say?
I don't know. That's just what the kids, that's what our kids say.
Okay.
I don't know how many people are going around talking about being hashtag sponsored. That's dumb to me. I don't want that. I don't need it. And if ever I feel like it's too much, I will shut it down. You know what I'm saying? And go right on back to, I still have my private Instagram,
that's still use
my private Facebook. I still use it. But yeah, I just felt like, I wanted to have a platform. Some of it was me acknowledging where we already were. Like, we were already public. You know what I'm saying? And
you needed to be able to define yourself for yourself.
For myself, and stop letting all these talking blue checks, running around, speaking on my life like they knew me. Look, I'm getting mad.
Oh, right. I was going to say, what? You just made a shift.
I know. Oh, my gosh. I can't talk about that without getting angry. But these people who were speaking on my life like they knew it, and they didn't. And I just like, no, I have a voice. I have a platform. I'm going to use it. I'm going to speak on my life, right? And define for people who I actually am and who we actually are together. And so that's why I chose to, quote unquote, go public, because I was tired of people talking about me like they knew me. And I wanted to be able to speak for myself.
Well, I think you have shared a lot of your story here, and I'm grateful that we get to share it with our listeners here on our podcast, Married to the Movement. And it's been great to interview you. I've enjoyed it. How was I as an interviewer?
I mean, I guess you were fine.
That's it?
I mean, okay, you were good. I mean, here's the thing. Like, you didn't make me cry, like Oprah does. Or
I said at the beginning that I was not going to do, I wasn't going to go deep.
Right. Because I wouldn't have done all of that.
Right. All right. Well, it was good to talk with you. And I think this will help people understand, as we share more of our stories and lessons on future episodes, it'll help them know who they were hearing from.
Absolutely.
All right.
Married to the Movement is brought to you by the North Star. We're so grateful to our members who make this and all the North Star content possible. Members of the North Star will always have access to this content first. So if you're not a member, you can head over to thenorthstar.com, click join now, and access this podcast, as well as a daily column from Sean King, show notes from The Breakdown, and other news for as little as $5 monthly. We super appreciate your support. Shout out to our senior producer, Willis, our podcasting director, Lysandra, and our creative director, Tone, for their work on today's episode. New episode live next week.